Good morning. May it please the court. This is a case about application of the discovery rule and the summary judgment burdens associated with a defendant's effort to establish the affirmative defense of preemption of state law regarding a usurious and illegal loan. The district court correctly held, consistent with this court's precedent, that preemption is an affirmative defense, that the plaintiff need not plead around it, and that the defendant carries the burden of proof at all times. The burden of establishing the affirmative defense requires a showing of five elements in this case. First, that the defendant is a housing creditor, because only housing creditors, as defined by the regulations, are entitled to preemption, and that in their capacity as a housing creditor, they complied with four specifically enumerated regulations promulgated by the OTS. One concerning the use of an index that's allowed in an adjustable rate loan. One concerning how late fees are assessed and disclosed on the billing statement. One concerning how variable rate change notices are sent. And one concerning whether the consumer is given a handbook prepared by the Department of Treasury called the Consumer Handbook on Adjustable Rate Mortgages. The defendants, by the time the summary judgment briefing came, at the close of discovery, did not have any evidence on two of those points. So the plaintiffs brought a Celotex-style motion, and we pointed to the deficiency in proof. We said there's no evidence that you're a housing creditor, and we said there's no evidence that you complied with the late fee regulations. In response to our motion for summary judgment, the defendant comes forth with two affidavits, one from a senior vice president named Mr. Al LaPena, and one from a customer service representative named Ms. Gonzalez. Mr. LaPena says, of course we're a housing creditor. In order to be a housing creditor, you must be licensed by the state, which we are, and he attaches the license, a document never disclosed in discovery, and says, we regularly make alternative loans. Indeed, we make 4,900 some odd variable rate loans in the applicable year. Again, a fact never disclosed in discovery, never disclosed under Rule 26A. Same thing with the Gonzalez affidavit. She was not disclosed as a witness under Rule 26A.
When you say never disclosed in discovery, that includes possible depositions of those two people, I guess.
That is correct.
I guess you'd say it's up to them to depose her or whatever. I don't know what, when you had the opportunity to depose her, you chose not to show those two people, right?
When we were given the opportunity after the close of discovery, when we were given 3 weeks to complete all these depositions, we chose not to. That's correct, because it wouldn't have helped.
Well, it wouldn't have helped you, obviously.
Well, that's correct. It would not. I mean, for instance, let's take the LaPena affidavit. I mean, he attached a license, and he said we made 4,900 loans. I don't think on cross-examination I would cause him to say, well, no, that's really, you know, we dummied up the license, it's fake, and, you know, we didn't really make these loans. I mean, I think, you know, in an epistemological sense, those facts are true. Now, is a defendant, or a plaintiff for that matter, or a party, going to be excused from complying with the mandatory burden of Rule 26A simply because the facts they don't disclose are true? I suppose that might go to the issue of whether it's harmless under the sanction to be imposed under Rule 37, but it's not substantially justified, and it's not harmless, because we wouldn't even necessarily have moved for summary judgment had we known they were going to be allowed to do that. We could have waited till trial, and when they didn't put that proof on at trial, moved for a judgment as a matter of law. Basically, what we did was we alerted them to their defects in proof, and they were allowed to patch it up after the fact. That really will be a deterrent to bringing Celotex motions on both sides, plaintiff and defendant, if you can simply patch it up after the fact. It was always their burden. Why would we go and try to elicit discovery that harms our case? That was the whole reason Rule 26A was changed. As the panel is well aware, the rule used to be that you had to disclose all facts relevant to the claims alleged with particularity in the pleadings. And what was happening is that people were starting to deal with the issue, well, it wasn't really relevant. What it really was harmful. And the Rules Committee said to eliminate the heartburn associated with producing harmful evidence voluntarily, what we're only going to make you do is give up the good stuff. Each side has to give up the stuff that helps their case. Now, if I wanted to extract evidence from them that I needed to prove my case, that was only in their possession, then I would use discovery means. interrogatories, document requests. I didn't need to do that. We had all the proof we needed to prove our case in our possession when we filed it. We had a note that showed the interest rate was above 8%. We had a document rider that showed there was a prepayment penalty. That violates the Interest Act. They had the burden on the affirmative defense. They didn't come forward with the evidence on the affirmative defense. They didn't show that it was substantially justified. Indeed, they could have put these witnesses up in response to the 30B6 deposition notice. It's not like we didn't conduct any discovery at all. You know, in addition to relying on Rule 26, which we're entitled to do, we asked them to designate all the representatives that have knowledge of the facts that they are going to use to prove their affirmative defense. Surely they knew they must prove they're a housing creditor and that their late fee notices complied with the statute, so they could have put LaPina and Gonzalez as designees in response to the 30B6 notice. They didn't do that either. They put up their corporate compliance officer, Ms. Nyman, and she answered, I don't know, to a lot of questions. And I'm getting ahead of myself as regards one of the issues. One of the issues is, did they deliver this handbook on adjustable rate mortgages? That, you know, there's an issue of fact. We knew going into the case they may rely on preemption. And we knew going into the case that our client never received this handbook. And so we knew that at a minimum there was going to be a genuine issue of fact on the affirmative defense as regards the book, which is only one of four regulations. Now, whether they were going to be able to come forward and adduce proof on the other regulations and the other elements of their defense, we didn't know. But going in, we knew that we had a slam dunk case on liability on the Interest Act, because that was proven by the documents, and a question, at least a question, about whether he got the book. So when they moved to dismiss, you know, we said we didn't plead around preemption, you know, first we said we didn't have to, and Judge Gottschall agreed, but we said, but even if we, you know, just to let you know, to kind of give you a preview of where we're going, you know, he didn't get this book, so at least one of the regulations wasn't complied with. Now, the defendant wants to say that, well, that was the whole case, and so basically they could ignore their other obligations. But that doesn't really make sense. Let's assume you have a TILA case, and you know that the real fighting is going to be about how the finance charge was disclosed. It doesn't excuse the plaintiff from proving the defendant was a creditor. Or in an FDCPA case, you know, the real fight might be whether there was overshadowing. It doesn't excuse the plaintiff from proving that the defendant is a debt collector. And surely, a defendant could bring a TILA text motion in those circumstances and say, there's no evidence that the defendant's a creditor or a debt collector. And the court would look at the record and say, yeah, there's no evidence. And if the plaintiff came forward and said, oh, we want a discovery do-over, I think that it would be an abuse of discretion to allow that. Because parties are allowed to rely, should be allowed to rely on the rules. Especially in cases like this, especially in cases where there's fee and cost shifting, and you want to make sure that the cases are litigated as efficiently as possible. Now, could we have done things differently had we known? Yes. Could we have adopted a litigation strategy? Certainly. Let's take this issue about these mailing procedures. This witness, Mr. Pham, comes forward, and he says, we always mail the book. Now, again, he wasn't the designee on that point. Ms. Nyman was. And I asked her a bunch of questions. Do you have a checklist? I don't know. Do you count the books? I don't know. When do you order the books? I don't know. So after being exposed to my cross-examination strategy with the 30B6 witness, this Pham guy comes and cleans up all the holes and says, yes, we have a checklist. And, you know, yes, we always mail the book. I would contend under this court's authority in Godfrey and comparing it to the Second Circuit case in Meckel that testimony is even insufficient facially. But let's just put that aside for a second. Had they said, we're going to put this witness on, his name is Mr. Pham, and he always mails the book. Again, my remedy would not have been to depose him. I don't fancy myself Perry Mason. I don't think he's going to all of a sudden break down in the deposition and say, oh, I didn't really, you know, we don't always mail the book. But we could have designated an expert. We could have audited their mailing procedures. We could have asked for their customer list and randomly sampled how many people did or didn't get the book, all of which would be probative on whether their evidence is that they always mail the book. Now, even if you let the Pham affidavit in, there's still an issue of fact. Pham says we always mail the book, kind of conclusorily. You know, I have some good points at trial that I think I can cross him on that will show to the jury that he's not credible. And Mr. McCarthy says, I never received the book. That's a fact question. The defendant and the district court relied heavily on this written acknowledgement, which is one of the hundreds of documents signed at the closing saying, I acknowledge receipt of the following documents. And then they list a bunch, one of which is the book, if applicable. How is Mr. McCarthy going to know if the book was applicable? And under the TILA, the statute holds that the acknowledgments create at best a rebuttable presumption of delivery, a rebuttable presumption that disappears when Mr. McCarthy gives contrary to the testimony. So there's a fact issue on the book. They didn't meet their burden of proof on the other regulations. We should have gotten a summary judgment on the affirmative defense of preemption, and the underlying cause and the merits should be remanded for trial. I'll save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Do you want to speak at all to whether the Act applies to servicers?
Well, the Act applies to servicers, yes. The Act says that anybody that contracts for or receives prepayment penalties is subject to the Interest Act. Here, option one received the prepayment penalty on behalf of an undisclosed principal, presumably some kind of securitization trust. Option one at all times held itself out as the owner of the loan. It was the one sending the billing statements. It was the one that has discretion whether or not to waive the prepayment penalty. It makes the decisions about whether or not to foreclose. So to say that, you know, they have a contractual duty after they receive it to pass it on is irrelevant. The statute prohibits receiving it. How they spend it, you know, what they do with it pursuant to their contract is irrelevant. That's plain language of the statute says anyone that receives it. And from McCarthy's perspective, option one was not a mere servant.
Well,
they were the only one to know.
The statute also speaks to the damages, and it says they're recoverable only against the lender, right?
The penalty may only be recoverable against the lender. That issue hasn't been fully briefed below. You know, whether there's a violation of the statute would at a minimum void the note and mortgage. Whether the penalty can be assessed is a different question. Indeed, the language in the penalty provision, which does talk specifically about a lender, is different than the prohibition provision that says you shall not contract for or receive. The note could be void, and they have to disgorge all the money they received under the void note, but could argue potentially they're not subject to the penalty. That issue hasn't been briefed. It's not before the court, and I presume if the court remands, it'll be briefed. Unless there are any further questions, I'll save a little time I have for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Stipe?
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Todd Stipe on behalf of the appellees, Option 1 Mortgage and DNC Mortgage. I'll first start with the last issue we were talking about the servicer issue. The Section 6 of the Illinois Interest Act, that is the enforcement section of the Illinois Interest Act, by its express terms, only applies to lenders. It is undisputed, based on the record, that Option 1 was not the lender with respect to this loan. This court, in Jackson versus Resolution GGF OI, noted that Section 6 of the Illinois Interest Act, the penalty provision, only applies to the lender. Option 1's actions were subject to a servicing contract with the owner of the loan, and they had no discretion under the contract whether or not to waive the prepayment penalty. Second, with respect to the issues raised in regard to discovery, one thing the court should know is that the plaintiff served absolutely no written discovery in this case. There was no interrogatories, request to admit, and no request for documents. The only discovery done by the plaintiff in this case was Rule 30b-6 depositions. So with respect to the FOM issue, Vin FOM, he was identified in our Rule 26 disclosure. He was identified as a witness. In addition, in the Rule 30b-6 deposition of Karen Neiman, which covered, by the way, the housing creditor issue as well as all the other issues related to the Parity Act, when he started asking specific questions about the detailed questions about the document department, she expressly identified, well, Vin FOM would be able to answer that. So he was identified again before the close of discovery as somebody that would have relevant information in this case. He chose not to depose this witness. This witness was fully disclosed, fully identified to the plaintiff. Again, when he filed his motion to strike, The court responded by allowing him another opportunity to depose these witnesses, which he again did not pursue. With respect to the other witnesses he talked about, the Lupina and Gonzalez, one thing the court should recognize is that there was a motion to dismiss in this case, and there was an order in connection to that motion to dismiss. And the order said is that there was no dispute regarding whether BNC was a housing creditor. And then it went on to say, in denying the motion to dismiss, that the defendants could be successful on a motion for summary judgment if they can show that they, in fact, complied with the regulation pertaining to the adjustable rate mortgage booklet. So the issue had been defined as relating to this adjustable rate booklet. Then we went on to discovery, and as I said, there was no written discovery, but there was a 30B6 witness identified by both defendants. And they were identified for they were identified to discuss all fact issues relating to this Parity Act defense, including the housing creditor issue. The plaintiffs did not ask a single question relating to this housing creditor issue or any other issue except focusing on this ARM booklet and the procedures related to the ARM booklet. Then he waits for discovery after serving no discovery requests, after not asking questions regarding these areas, and files a motion for summary judgment. Motion summary judgment doesn't have anything to do with the burden of proof or so on. It has to do with what the obligations were under discovery. What he did is he didn't do any discovery, he didn't ask for information, and then filed a motion to dismiss based on the fact that he said, well, I don't have any information. Well, he never pursued it in discovery. He's trying to place a rule where we have to voluntarily provide him with documentation. There's no rule unless he actually asked for it. Rule 26, rule he relies for, requires us to identify by category documents. He did not send any discovery requests in this case. So when he came in to say, well, hey, you haven't proved that you are a housing creditor, that we have no facts that we never asked for, we came back with an affidavit from Al Lupina saying clearly they are a housing creditor. We could have used Neiman, but she had left the company by then, and we had her available to discuss this issue. He just decided not to pursue it. So, I mean, we were actually kind of ambushed in that sense. Getting back to what I think is the real issue in this case, the real substantive issue in this case, and that is application of the Parity Act. And our position is the Parity Act needs to be construed and interpreted consistent with its purpose. The purpose is set out in the statute and was again reiterated by the Fourth Circuit in the Faith case, and that is to eliminate the discriminatory impact upon non-federally chartered institutions by providing them with the option of making adjustable rate loans and according to federal regulations identified by the OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision. With respect to...
Was this some kind of a distress loan? You indicated in your brief, I guess, that this fellow had pretty big credit problems and had to really search to get even and get a loan.
That's true. I don't know.
Did the Parity Act have some recognition of that?
No.
Or is it strictly non-federally?
You have to be a housing creditor, and it has to be an alternative loan. There's no restriction, or it doesn't address the issue of what the interest rate could be or anything like that.
No, alternative to?
Alternative to a fixed interest. This one is an adjustable
rate
loan.
But the institution isn't federally insured? Is that what it is?
It's a state chartered institution, not a federal savings and loan.
Does it have any federal connection? Is it federally insured, for example?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. But what it does is that it allows a state charter institution to provide these adjustable rate type loans by stepping into the rules that would be applicable to a federal institution. So that's where the parity comes from. And the reason why the preemption applies is because the federal institutions are allowed to assess prepayment charges. So I think what the main issue in this case, his claim is that because he asserts that he did not receive an ARM booklet in the mail prior to closing, that automatically creates an issue to go to trial. That anybody that relies, any institution that relies on the Parity Act would be facing a trial based purely on a borrower's assertion that he didn't receive this booklet in the mail. And I'm submitting that I don't think that interpretation of the evidentiary burden with respect to that rule is consistent with the purpose and policy set out in the Act. In this case, there was no dispute regarding most of the criteria for a alternative, for application of the Parity Act. Whether BMC was a housing creditor, as you noted, we had testimony that it was a housing creditor. This testimony is undisputed. Whether the late charge and billing statements were sent out consistent with the rule, undisputed testimony that they were. Whether the prepayment charge was in the contract, the third rule, no dispute that there was a fully disclosed prepayment charge in the note. The LIBOR index, we submitted a OTF, the index we used was LIBOR. We submitted an OTF opinion letter which states that this precise index is proper under its rules. And that leaves us with the one remaining OTF regulation. That's the OTF regulation that pertains to the disclosure of the ARM booklet. What this rule says is that you must provide an ARM booklet, which is identified in the TILA regulations. The TILA regulations are applicable to adjustable rate loans. 226.19B, that is the TILA regulation that identifies this particular ARM handbook or ARM booklet, says it must be placed in the mail with no later than 3 days after the lender receives the application from the broker. So the obligation is to place it in the mail. His only evidence in this case, the only evidence he submitted in this case, is that he didn't receive an ARM booklet. So the question is whether his bare assertion that he didn't receive an ARM booklet is enough, regardless of the evidence that is provided by the defendant, indicating that they had procedures in place, indicating that the procedures were followed with respect to this loan, and that an signed acknowledgement that he signed by the borrower that he had received the ARM booklet is in the record as well. Despite all this evidence, he says his mere assertion that he didn't receive it is enough to create a fact for trial. He bases this entire linchpin of this case is relying on a TILA section, TILA section 15 U.S.C. 1635C, and he's trying to apply that to the Parity Act. 1635C applies only to the receipt of TILA disclosures by a person to whom information, forms, and a statement is required to be given pursuant to this section. This section is 1635. This section does not apply to residential mortgage transactions. It says so expressly in the section, including purchase money mortgages, which we have here. So the rule he is relying on to create this rule of evidence that his mere assertion creates in the trial is based on a rule that doesn't apply to this type of loan. It also doesn't apply to the Parity Act. It applies to TILA, or Truth in Lending Act, and which have completely different considerations with respect to the policies and purposes. For instance, while the Parity Act only requires substantial compliance with the regulations, Truth in Lending Act requires strict compliance, and it's intended to protect consumers. The Parity Act is intended to provide parity. Furthermore, if this ARM booklet had not been delivered under the Truth in Lending Act, because this is a non-material disclosure, under the Truth in Lending Act, the sanction would be a statutory penalty of $200 to $2,000. In this case, what is at stake is the loss of preemption and his claim for $800,000. So I mean, I think there's a clear, when you consider the purpose and policy of the Act, I think there's a clear argument that this rule that he's trying to apply in order to create a trial based on his own assertion doesn't apply to substantial compliance under the Parity Act.
Are there any cases that this penalty has been applied, that doubling of the interest rate that would otherwise have been collected over the term?
It has been applied to lenders in state court cases, yes.
So is that somebody different than, since they're not a lender, that the, they wouldn't be?
Option one is not a lender, they're the servicer. So the court ruling was that the Illinois interest rate doesn't even apply to them. BNC is the lender, so they would be covered by the Illinois Interest Act, but the Illinois Interest Act is preempted with respect to in this case, because it's an alternative rate mortgage, and we satisfied the other requisites for the Parity Act. But there are no cases in Illinois here where they're talking about the Parity Act with respect to prepayment penalties. I would mention, though, that the state regulatory authority, the OBRE, had made a statement that the Illinois Interest Act is, with respect to prepayment penalties, is preempted by the Parity Act. So, the legal issue of whether, if the Parity Act applied, the Illinois Interest Act would be preempted is not at issue before this court. That's not an issue that's been raised on the issues for appeal. And the case law is clear that that preemption penalties are subject, state law restrictions on prepayment penalties are subject to being preempted under the Parity Act. So the issue is, does the Parity Act apply? And I think the evidence on the record is clear that we more than satisfied the burden with respect to each of the elements required for the Parity Act to apply to this one. So to summarize, and one last point I want to make, in his briefing, he raises several new arguments in this reply brief that were not only not raised below, but don't appear in his original brief. And I just want to comment on that we haven't had a chance to respond to these new arguments, and I believe under the Seventh Circuit rule that they would be waived. If there's not any more questions.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Tyler.
Thank you.
Mr. Lamb?
I don't think we made any new arguments, but I do want to address two of Judge Mannion's questions, the first regarding whether the lender is federally insured, and the second regarding the nature and extent of the penalty. The lender is not federally insured. It is a mortgage company. It is not a bank. And indeed, that's one of the key issues here, is because underlying preemption policy is that banks that have to follow this extensive regulatory scheme imposed by the federal government shouldn't have to worry about the kind of the patchwork quilt of state law, because they're extensively regulated by federal law. To put some parity so that state chartered lenders and alternative mortgage companies could have some equivalence, they are allowed to claim preemption, but only if they can show compliance with the federal regulations. Preemption doesn't mean you get to just blow off state law. It says that if you're regulated by the federal regulations and you follow those regulations, then you're preempted. You don't have to serve two masters, so to speak. If you follow the federal regulations, you can claim preemption. Compliance is the price of preemption. So the burden on them is to show compliance, and they know that. Their witness testified that they know all about preemption and the requirements of state law. So it shouldn't be too burdensome for them to prove these four points. Now, the penalty issue has not, there's been no record established on that. You know, if there's a remand, and if there's a trial, and if we win, and if the jury awards a penalty, and if the court sustains the penalty, if the defendant could put forth arguments that it might be excessive under BMW v. Gore or whatnot, you know, I don't want this panel to get sticker shock about the penalty. The district court mentioned it. It almost seemed like it was a motivating factor. The district court said this is a real harsh penalty. But that doesn't justify ignoring Rule 26. It doesn't justify excusing the defendant from their burden on liability. We can address the propriety of the penalty on remand. That's not before this court. The issues before this court are whether or not Rule 26 is going to mean anything. This court hasn't addressed Rule 26 in the mandatory disclosure regime since it was changed in 2000. It doesn't often get the opportunity to address these issues. Because this comes up in the unique context of an affirmative defense, it's a good opportunity to send a message about that Rule 26 means something. We don't have to conduct written discovery. In conclusion, I'd like to say that when I first practiced law, one of my mentors said, you know, that interrogatories were to some extent a waste of time because all they did was kind of force the other side to think about their case and think about how they have to prove it. I didn't want to do that. I kind of got the indication they weren't going to be able to prove their affirmative defense because they didn't do the research about what they needed to prove. And in our adversarial system of justice, I don't need to use written discovery to give them a roadmap as to what they need to prove and elicit evidence harmful to my case. Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.